Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the experience tables for character advancement in D&D over the years. Should they be customized to each class or one universal table? Do you like an easy-to-remember formula or careful fine-tuning at each level? Which one is best? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord. Get your account set up over there before the show is over, and maybe about 10 or 15 minutes after the end of the show, we will be there to talk to you all live.
We love our patrons. We love getting a chance to chat with them every week. Big thanks to Backrius for checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. And you know, Paul, today's topic came from one of our patrons, specifically Backrius, actually suggested, you know, hey, you haven't talked about your opinions about how different, you know, the advancement XP tables have been very, very different across editions. And it's not something we ever chatted about. So great idea for a chat today. And we thank our patrons for that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is timely for me as well, because just yesterday I ran another session of my Quest game. And Quest, okay. I'm sure, as you know, Dan, has no XP tables. There's no level system of any kind other than abilities. You gain additional abilities as you level up. And the simple rule in the book is just after each session, you get another one, the end. And the funny thing is, when I first started playing, that's how I was running it. It felt to me like we were racing through stuff. So I thought, oh, we better slow this down. And then I tried to tie advancement to story goals or something.
Interesting.
Or just something else. Yeah. So I've slowed it down a bit. And I'm finding I really don't like that. I know we're going to focus primarily in this episode on like the tables and how different characters advance. And it's less about what gains you advancements, although I think you can't really talk about how many points it takes to level up without talking about what gets you those points. I'm definitely rethinking what.
And before we get started, I'll point our viewers. We did have an episode in the past where we discussed that specific issue of what are the awards like. That's back in season 2, episode 7, so folks can see that. But you're right, Paul. You can't touch on one without the other.
Yeah. So I'm very curious to see where this goes because I'm definitely dissatisfied with what I'm doing in Quest right now. Simply because I will say this: I don't like awarding advancements by pure fiat. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
I feel like I constantly have too much influence on the throttle, and I would rather it be a little more cut and dry so I don't have to think about, should I give them an advancement this time? I don't know how am I feeling. That sucks. I'd rather just go, oh, you did X, you get an advancement.
I agree with that. That's as an initial starting point. I totally agree with that motivation. I like it to be a bit more objective. And not, again, like you're saying, not just fiat by the DM, but do I feel good about the players today or not? You know, sometimes they need to beat me. Sometimes I need to give them a reward when I feel bad about it.
And you'll find as we go in this conversation today, Dan, there are probably places where I'm going to bend that a little bit more than you're comfortable with. That's my gut instinct. Okay. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that seems likely.
Where do you want to start?
Okay, let's walk through. Okay, so the very first thing is for newer players who may not be familiar with this. Prior to 2000, every character class had their own experience advancement table, right? After third edition, there's only ever been one advancement table for every type of character, but prior to that, every class was customized. So maybe we should introduce that from original D&D to begin with. So I have that image with the red dot there. And so these are the advancement tables for what we would now call fighters and wizards and clerics and thieves in original D&D 1974. Now, the bottom right, I've added the thief table that was added a year later in the supplement because thieves weren't there originally. And you can see the level titles and the experience points needed. And Paul, your the first thing that we both had to annotate in pencil in our books was what?
Yeah, it super bothers me that the number of the level is not present here. So you can certainly see in my own copy of OD&D here, I've penciled in the level numbers and then of course dropped the table there, in at the bottom just so that I had it all on one page and I could just look at it.
Same.
Yeah.
So, they just didn't think about that yet, that was an important thing. I mean, you have the title. You're a hero, you're a superhero, you're a lord. What more do you want? You know what's going on.
What more do you need, Dan? I mean, the other interesting thing I'll point out about these tables is that the top level, the number of the highest level is different, right?
Correct.
Fighting man maxes out at 9, magic user maxes out at 11, cleric maxes out at 8, and thief maxes out at 10.
Correct.
So they're they're all different. All of them. Each one is unique.
And you know, like a lot of stuff.
Oh, but you can level up infinitely by extra amounts.
True. Whatever. But that, what you can definitely call the name level, if you, particularly if you're coming from more of a BX background, Paul, where Moldvay did synchronize that at 9 for every class. But yeah, initially throughout original D&D, and that was maintained in advanced D&D, the name level is either 8, 9, 10, or 11, depending on which of these classes you're at. So that's that can be an unexpected surprise. And that has a major, I think, maybe unanticipated effect on the numbers that result from that. And so you can see here that, if we take the fighter, the fighting man as the basis, right, in these rules, it takes 2,000 XP to hit second level, and then it more or less doubles, right? And then it goes 4,000, 8, 16, 32 is what they're doubling. The magic users take a little bit more, and then the clerics take significantly less, and the thieves take even less than that to get to second level. And they're kind of more or less doubling each time. Now, if you look
go
ahead.
And I'm going to jump in here, though. Is it significant? If you look at, say, what it takes to get to level 2, right? The mm-hmm. fighting man needs 2,000. The magic user needs 2,500. The cleric needs 1,500. So we're off mm-hmm. by a factor of 500 or, roughly 25% of what it takes the fighting man to advance. Here's what I want to toss in there. So when I was running BX, one of the first things I house ruled was a race class split. Right. And so one of the, I know I'm kind of getting ahead of us, but when we get to BX, we'll discover because of races class, now you have 7 different charts because elves and dwarves and halflings have their own charts. But I thought at that time, I thought it makes sense that the demi-human classes are more expensive because they're kind of almost implicit multi-class-ish type characters. This is actually something, by the way, that I think Old School Essentials essentially agrees with me completely on, and it does the same thing. So I was like, oh, I'll add an XP cost. If you want to be an elf, since now you can be any of the classes, if you're an elf, it costs 10 or 20% XP more to level up. And I just don't think that's significant enough. I don't think that matters or anyone cares. Much like the prime requisite bonus, I don't think those percentages are big enough to matter. And I even question this 25% bump. Is this so big of a bump that you really notice?
Now, on the one hand, I totally 100% agree with a 25% bump doesn't make a big difference. And I also think that that's kind of a puzzling choice here. Now, one trap that we might fall into is that we tend to get focused on just that first level. And it's important not to lose sight of the fact that they don't maintain the doubling consistently. And again, if you look at BX, that is something they set up and was very consistent. So you might possibly expect that later on. But if you look at the later levels, it's not consistent, particularly, I think someone in the chat said, the table for magic users is totally whack. Because when you get up to the magician level, which happens to be 6, notice that the 20 to 35,000 is not doubling. And it's not doubling up to the next one. And then you notice that the sorcerer, necromancer, wizard, as you get up towards name level, is only adding 100k, 100k, 100k each step. Whereas at this point, The Fighting Man has added 120K, which is actually more than that. So, like the Warlock is, level, is that, right?
So you're saying that's specific to OD&D. When we flip to BX, we're going to see this even out. We're going to see that.
Correct.
The weirdness of the magic user.
They normalize it to basically be doubling for all the classes. Yes. And you notice, at the Warlock, like the superhero Warlock level, which is level 8, it takes less XP to get a magic user there. Right, I get to 8th level faster as a magic user than I do as a fighting man, regardless of what happened in that third, fourth level there. So it's non-linear, and there's a point where magic users actually start outpacing fighters, which is not what you would expect. And again, I'm not entirely sure why that. I mean, allegedly Gary was just kind of favored magic users himself, Mordenkainen and folks like that. So maybe he was just giving a little boost to magic users in that upper level? Question mark?
I mean, the thief gets a little strange at the end too, right? That's doubling and doubling till about pilferer, right? And then now it's only a 20K increase from 40 to 60, and then 60 to 90. We're only going to that's weird. That's weird.
Now, here's the real puzzle. Here's the real puzzle, is original D&D is totally explicit in the text that there's no limit to levels. You can level up as much as you want, and like for the spellcasters, there's even a formula of how many spells you're going to add at any arbitrary higher level. But the question is, how much experience does it take to get to those levels that are off the tables? Now, in the original publication, 1974, they didn't think to tell you that explicitly. You see that there's no such note for fighting men, magic users, clerics. Now, in the supplement, for the first time, they thought to address that specifically for the thieves. And you can see that in the bottom right here. It says, okay, for additional levels beyond the table, it's going to be 125K. But how much for the other classes? Question mark. And your first instinct might be, well, maybe it continues the last increment. So, like, to get to Lord, you had to add 120K. Maybe that's the pattern that should continue. And for magic users, the last several levels were all adding 100K, so clearly that's a pattern that should continue. But hey, wait. Turns out, no. This has been addressed by one of the earliest players, Mike Mornern, who played with both Gygax and Arneson at the tables. And what he revealed is that the increment past the table is whatever the last number appearing is, whatever the value was for that class's name level. And remember, they don't all have the name level at the same level. So one class will have more of these close to doublings than another. So what they actually did at the tables, and this is maintained in advance, I'll point out, is that for fighters, you have to add 240K. And for clerics, you only have to add 100K for each level. And then suddenly for magic users that have been going 100 and 100 and 100, now you need to add 300 and another 300.
Fascinating.
And another 300, right? And it's this huge increment. And from that point on, clerics and thieves are basically advancing twice as fast as fighters.
It's very strange too, and especially because I always thought that the so-called geometric progression of XP per level was a benefit of the older editions, but clearly that just stops after name level, and now it just becomes linear, which I find also odd. Why don't we continue to double?
You're not getting full benefits, right? You're not getting to roll new hit dice. The attack tables, if you're using attack tables, probably ran out at that point. So there's a lot of benefits that have basically you've hit the end of your saving throw table. So you're just getting a couple of fixed hit points each level, and you're probably not getting full benefits, would be an argument.
So weird. Okay. So, but that said, like, one of the things that I've said in the past is what I liked about the geometric progression is that, in theory, if a player character dies and they come back, you could start them out at first level, and the amount of XP they need to catch up to everyone else is the same as how much that group needs to go up one level.
I agree.
I liked that. That felt nice to me. Granted, I will say, like, I've not And frankly, I've never played at that high level. And so there's a little bit, like a lot of this discussion that we're having here almost feels just weirdly theoretical to me, because have I ever played 12, 13, 14, 15th levels? No, I have not.
Yeah.
Nor can I imagine ever doing
it. A bit of a surprise that came up for me and Paul that we were discussing about a week ago is that when we were making pre-generated player characters, and I made some as high as like 12th level, we like to equate the experience points. Seems like a thing that we ought to do. And somewhat surprising to both of us, the way that the increments past the table run is that if I make a 12th level fighter, that same number of experience actually equates to a 17th level thief. So that's kind of why you have this surprisingly high range of characters when you do play adventures at a particular XP level, which is weird.
But I've never encountered that again because I've never played those highest levels. Mm-hmm. In all of my highest batch of characters is level 7 to 9. And generally when making my pregens, this is exactly what I do. I pick an XP amount that generally, and usually I'm looking at the fighting man table to figure out what XP amount I want. And usually what happens is the magic user is a level behind and the thief is a level ahead. And so there's your 7 to 9, right? I got an 8th level fighter, so I get my 7th level magic user and my 9th level thief in there. And then also I like that usually if I then give that XP to my multi-class characters, they end out about a level or so behind. So instead of a level 8 fighting man, they might be a level 7 fighting man, level 6 magic user or something like that.
Yeah. And that was my intent.
Not exactly that, but they're a little behind.
Yeah. And that was my intent as well. And, you know, thinking about the very simple system in BX, I think that was kind of my basis. But then I tried to make it happen, and that intent breaks down around 10th level. And again, you can see that at around 8th level, the magic user is actually going to be a level ahead. And they go from behind to ahead, back to behind. And at least based on these tables, it's not regular like that, surprisingly.
I'm assuming where we're headed here, Dan, is that this is so wonky that you have decided not to use it and prefer the BX table.
I have not.
Nope.
I've embraced the wonkiness.
Shocking.
And I guess that was part of our post conversation last week, actually. And I think what I would say is, again, I generally try to say, look, I've based my rules on original D&D. That's that you can pick that up. It's short rules. And you know, I call it original edition Delta, as I'm trying to make the smallest changes I can get away with. And I don't think that's something that completely cripples the play at the table. So it's not something I've bothered to write text about what to do differently. But
I've kind of circumvented the wonkiness a bit by simply never playing above level 9.
That's, you know, there you go. There you go. And I got to admit, you know, a real early D&D was clearly play tested and beaten on up to about that level, frankly. And there is a formula that you can proceed, but the warranty is off. There's no guarantee after that, because the truth is, and Gygax would even say that in those early days, none of us have played a past 14th level at that time, actually. Now I would like to look at, and I just reminded myself that this morning of, like, because there's an earlier version, right? We were looking at the first publication, but there's an earlier version, because there is a version in the pre-publication draft, right, before D&D was ever published, and this was revealed in the court proceedings when Dave Arneson sued Gary Gygax and TSR in 1979. And so here this is typed out on a manual typewriter sometime prior to 74. It's got hand annotations. I know that it's dim, probably written in by Gygax. And you can see that in the center column there is the fighting man table, and it doesn't start at 2,000, it starts at 1,000, right? Which is what it should have been. See, that's a nice round number. And then it kind of goes up, right? It's pretty close to going up by 1,000 and 2,000 and 5,000 and 10,000, which some of us mathematically call the preferred number sequence for geometric-like scaling. It's the simplest, roundest numbers, right? It doesn't turn into 16, 32, 64, 128, 256. It's just 1, 2, 5, 10,000, and then more or less it's close to 20 and 50 and 100,000, pretty close to that. If you look at like the second level, the magic users are double and the clerics are half, And then, and clearly, if you went with those numbers, you really would have magic users behind by a level, and your clerics would be ahead by a level because of the times two and times a half. And I was very surprised that when I actually wrote down my like instinct, like if I had to do it from a complete blank page, what I would do. And then I dug this up this morning, and I'm like, that's more or less it. Why did we change?
Yeah. Well, is it about, right? And again, this is where I'm going to get into like, well, where are the awards coming from? Like how much XP do you get for doing stuff? And yeah. In this edition, right, we're talking about one XP per gold piece, right, of treasure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then yes. You know, maybe something roughly around 100 XP per hit die of monster when you kill them.
That's the first thing they said, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So which frankly, I always thought of like that 100 XP per hit die of monsters. It quickly becomes negligible, right? It's not that big of a swing. I think that the treasure is more the driver here, in my opinion.
The early levels certainly. I've done calculations where, and I know that that's what Moldvay says, right? I know that's what Moldvay says.
Yeah.
We might be tricked again at first level. Because at higher levels, surprisingly, you get tons and tons of treasure. And I believe in what Gygax was doing, it tends to be around half and half, which I know surprises people.
This is what I'm getting at, right? Like, if you wanted to use these tables, I would assume you should ergo cut your treasure rewards in half. And maybe you should drop to 50 XP per monster. No?
Nope. If you use the treasure awards that Gary seems to lay out in his adventures and his later work, it tends to come out to be about 50 more or less. I would personally support cutting the monster awards to maybe 50 per hit dice. Is actually a thing that I'm pretty close to doing myself.
But you would keep the amounts of treasure the same.
I would. I actually think that what he was doing is pretty reasonable. Yeah.
Okay.
And it works out to be about half and half.
Now I would say, right, again, this starts to border into my feeling around, you know, how much of this is by GM fiat. It depends on like how anal you are about actually rolling on the treasure tables all the time, 100% of the time. Even when you look at our own dungeon design dash, right, we've kind of come up with our own tables, or we're, you know, kind of going a little bit more by feel than by dictative rule. And it not necessarily per treasure award, but just like how much feels right. How many treasures should be in this adventure? And I feel like there should be more or less, right? We tend to do that a lot. And so I definitely find myself kind of in that same realm of thinking about. And it's the thing I'm not crazy about, right? Of thinking about, like, am I giving enough treasure? Am I giving enough treasure such that the advancement of the player characters feels good? Or is it going too fast or too slow?
I might have my eye a little bit more close on that than you do. So the system that we're currently using on Dungeon Design Dash is based on extrapolated numbers from Gary's monster and treasure assortment system, which I'm pretty convinced was his actual system. I've done extrapolated statistics to pull that out. I think it matches what he said elsewhere for expected advancement velocity,
I'm not talking about the amount of treasure in a single award, like a single room. You find this much treasure in this room. How many of the rooms have treasure?
Yeah.
How big is the adventure? How many rooms are in the adventure? How many of them have treasure in them? Right. And I definitely feel like we've had this conversation in the past where we've been looking at a dungeon design dash and going, oh, I feel like there's not enough treasure in here. We should.
Yeah, I'm tracking that. Again, I think it was too low in the past. And we've increased that recently to match the numbers better.
But what is that based on? Is that just based on a, like, I want this much advancement? I want this advancement rate per, you know, how are you figuring out that math? Are you saying that I expect them to go through this many rooms per this number per session, and ergo I want them to go this much forward in a level in a single session?
Okay, huge conversation. That could be several episodes. I wish I had time for a PhD thesis on that. Short answer to the question you just asked: yes, 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 and yes.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
Yeah. And that's and that's a thought process that I would like to have simplified for me. It's a thought process that is just too chunky, and the math is too convoluted. And oftentimes when I'm writing, and maybe I'm sure this is not the same for you, Dan. You know, you're probably already halfway through writing that thesis. For me personally, I'm like, at some point I throw up my hands and go, I don't know, man. Let's just chuck some treasure in and see what happens.
I have it down to one page. I haven't shown it to anybody. I haven't even shown it to you, Paul. But I have a one page guide for that in front of me when we're doing the Dungeon Design Dash stuff. And I haven't shown it to anybody because I figured that people aren't interested in the numbers enough, frankly. So I haven't bothered to shove it in anybody's face. But I have it down to one page.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, I would prefer personally a simpler system.
It's
I'm not asking you to end it now. I'm just saying it's enough variables that it
here's
blows my stack to try to think about it. Yeah.
That's it.
All right. So, well, you'll have to send it to me and let me review it.
Yeah, I will do that. Great. I apologize for not making that explicit previously.
a future episode when you and I go through. I'm just setting that context now for some stuff I'm going to say later as we dig into more stuff down.
Let's actually talk just for a second about expected velocity. Yeah. So I refer to this issue of how fast are you getting levels in classic D&D as the expected velocity, and you can find comments about it, and they don't agree in different people's rule books. So if you're looking at Moldvay Basic as one example, the last page of the book, he says, well, we expect 3 to 4 adventures to get to level 2. He doesn't comment about anything past that. So it's not, you can't track a whole campaign, but he expects 3 to 4 adventures, I guess probably a 4-hour session is what I'm guessing. And if you haven't gotten to second level in 3 or 4 adventures, it's too slow. If people have gotten to third level in that time, you're going too fast. Now, Holmes Basic says something totally different, is that he expects, and kind of it's the same treasure tables and all, and same experience tables and all that. Holmes says that there should be 6 to 12 games per level consistently. And that averages out to about 9 games per level is his expectation. So what is that, like triple? Triple the number of adventures from what Moldvay is recommending. And then a place where people tend to miss is Gygax went on record with this in the last Strategic Review magazine. And it's almost the last page of that magazine. So Strategic Review, technically number 7. And what he says is that it is reasonable to calculate that if a fair player takes part in 50 to 75 games in the course of a year, notice that's more than one game per week. That's like a game and a half per week. So 50 to 75 games in the course of a year, he should acquire sufficient experience points to make him about 9th to 11th level, assuming that he manages to survive all that play. Now, that works out to be an average of about 6 games per level up to around name level, like 10th level. And then for what it's worth, it says the acquisition of successively higher levels will be proportionate to enhanced power and the number of experience points necessary to attain them. So another year of play will by no means mean a doubling of levels, but rather the addition of perhaps 2 or 3 levels. Using this gauge, it should take 4 or 5 years to see 20th level. But to my certain knowledge, no player in either the Blackmoor or Greyhawk campaigns has risen above 14th. So all of this is entirely theoretical past that point, but at least up to about name level, Gygax is thinking about 6 games per level and playing a ton of D&D.
That is a lot. That is a lot. I'm trying to remember now my own experience of running a long running DX campaign, which I started in, I think, early 2010. How high did my, I don't, my, I will say we played for multiple years. We were trying to play once a week. Didn't always happen. I'm sure we were not playing quite the amount of games that Gary talks about here. But even if we say we played half as many games, did they get to name level in 2 years? No, they didn't.
Yeah.
And that's usually where I'm starting from, is simply like trying to guess How long do I expect this campaign to run? How long can I keep these people showing up and playing the same game week after week? Like, what? How frequently are we playing? And frankly, I would say it is excruciatingly rare for me that a campaign lasts more than a year.
And I think that's a good place. I think I agree that that is the place, if you're designing a system, that's a great place to start. That's a totally a great foundational lie. I'm pretty sure that the third and fifth edition designers explicitly were doing that same math about expected play sequence and how long it takes. Again, you know, the earliest books were never clear about their initial motivating principles, right? They'd give us these XP tables and they would not explain where they came from. But I agree that that's totally a great place to actually start designing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I sense that pragmatically, I probably need to adjust for a faster velocity than what I've experienced pragmatic play realistically, I've never, ever played a campaign where we got to the point where, like, gosh, the characters are maxing out in level. We should kill this thing and start afresh because we've hit the cap. Never happened.
I mean, do you want that, right? I mean, you know, the counter argument would be the promise of D&D initially was you can keep playing this forever to whatever level. I mean, is that something you want to see?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay,
I do want to see that. I don't want it to go on forever. Frankly, I do think that the game breaks down at the very high levels, right? I think the game breaks down and becomes a different game. And I don't necessarily want, again, if it goes on forever, if we're gonna play this campaign for the next 10 years, I don't want 5 of those years to be in the broken part. Right? So And the other thing is, there's a lot of games out there, Dan. There's a lot of different role-playing games out there. I like playing a lot of different role-playing games. I don't want to be locked into the same thing week after week for the next 10 years of my life.
And that's a place I don't entirely share the same instinct.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
There should be one true game there. That's the one I want to play. There's a game in the book.
I mean, and that's this is probably the core of all disagreements between Dan and Paul, is that simple fact of I want variety and Dan wants
to do it right,
to find the optimal game.
There you go. Well put. Maybe that's a good observation.
The core tension of Wandering DMs identified here in season 8.
That's pretty well observed. That's hard to disagree with. Great.
I don't know. That puts me in a weird place, right? Because it's hard for me to even draw the final line in the sand. Say, well, how long are we going to play for? And, you know, what do I want the experience to be at the end, right? Do I want us to go like, oh, well, we got to 7th level. That's pretty good. Or do I want to be like, we maxed our characters out. We got all the best spells. We got all the best stuff. We have played this game to the hilt. We've seen everything it's done. Or do I want it to end in more of that nebulous space of like, there could have been more, but we ran out of steam.
You know, I fear we might have glossed something over here, and that is, do you get experience for treasure? And of course, Paul and I have always played games where that's the expectation. That was no longer a core rule as of second edition, like 1990. So the early, you know, original AD&D BX, right, up through the 80s, always had as a core rule that every gold piece of treasure got you experience. Second edition made that optional, made that a non-default, and then that just disappeared from any of the later rule sets. So if you are playing, you know, if you came into the hobby second edition or later, this might be entirely foreign to you. The funny thing is that it seems like Gygax was putting some work in the early days to slow stuff down more. So that pre-draft had fighters get second level at 1,000, and then when you publish it, they slowed it down by half. And then you get to the first supplement, and they entirely changed the XP for monsters awards, at least at the outset, to way, way, way slow them down. And if the original book said you ought to get 100 XP per hit die in the first supplement, it's only 10 XP for the first hit die. So it slowed it down to 1/10 the beginning operating yeah. level. And Moldvay's take on that would be it should be far more important to get the treasure. And you know, take you could possibly
I don't have that chart from OD&D, but I can put up here. This is the chart from BX of
basically
how to map XP to killing monsters. And yes. at this point, yeah, a one hit die monster is worth 10. And it's and then we also then have to add the extra complexity of calculating how many special abilities they have and what does that even mean, and it gets messy.
Now I will point out, and I've done a blog post on this in the past, is again, you know, getting focused on the first level will trick you, because when you get up to the nosebleed levels, you're basically back at 100 XP per hit die. So if you look down at 10 hit dice, give you 900 XP. 11 hit dice give you 1100. 13 will give you about 1300. 20 will give you 2000. So if you graph this, it's parabolic, right? It's quadratic. My hand has to go the other way. It's quadratic for up through 1 through name level, and then it becomes linear, right? Matching the advancement tables that are linear after name level, and then the XP is linear per hit die from approximately level 10 on.
With one small exception, I would say, which is that those high level hit die monsters are probably going to have more special abilities than the low ones did, right? Goblins aren't running around with a lot of special abilities, whereas you throw in a 15 hit die monster, it's probably got 2, 3, 4 special abilities and that's going to ramp that up. So it's maybe even bigger, right? It's maybe even more than 100.
I'll confess that I tend to ignore that. I never use this table. I don't think you do either, Paul. Wise. And among other problems with it is that I guess a thesis that I have is all point buy systems are all inherently broken. Well, if I have a monster that's like poisons you to death, okay, that's the same ability whether I stick it on a 1-hit die monster or a 20-hit die monster. It shouldn't be worth different numbers. That's the same threat. The whole idea of 1 point for that ability at 1-hit die and 1,000 points at 20-hit dice just doesn't make any sense because it's the same threat. So I'll confess I tend not to look at that part of it.
Interesting. Yep. I think that's reasonable.
Take on that.
To hit my
larger point, right, there, at least to begin with, there was a goal of like reduce the monster XP so much that practically you're only concerned about the treasure. And it would have been a very small step to just entirely remove all the monster XP, zero out entirely, and have the game entirely be just go get treasure. That's where the experience comes from. And I think, again, it's a legitimate motivating point of what is the game that we want to model? What kind of behavior and what kind of motivations do we want to give our players? And there is definitely a big difference in thematics in, you know, edition 01BX, in which the players are presumably criminal rogues trying to steal money, versus second, third, fourth, you know, edition later, where they're noble heroes trying to defeat monsters. And that reward system kind of implies very different, you know, player activity. And I think it is useful to bear that in mind. And again, part of the reason why I actually like the earlier editions, because I like that play more than the noble hero play, frankly.
Here's an interesting that comment, I think, is pretty common in the OSR, right? I feel like it harkens back to Finch's old school primer, right, where he talks about like how, you know, treasure is really the driver, and I've parroted that many times at my own table of like, yep, in the old editions, if you sneak into the dragon's lair and steal the dragon's treasure, that's actually better than if you ran in there and killed the dragon, because, you know, it's less risk and you'll still get the XP award. Here's the interesting thing. I think we kind of looked at this. I'm gonna hand wave over across of a whole lot of different editions and whatnot. We can dive in wherever you want. as the editions got marched on, we moved further and further away from that, like, XP for treasure, right? It became optional, and then it just kind of went away. As you look at, like, third and fourth and fifth edition, it's just, here is the math for how to translate hit die of monster killed or challenge rating or whatever they wanted to say. You get XP for killing monsters, the end. And they might then give you some, like, here's some optional, okay, maybe you want to give story awards, maybe you... I know, fifth edition, maybe you want to do milestones at the whole thing. But nevertheless, the default is still kill monsters. That's how you get treasure. Yeah. The end. Now, if you look at maybe, I don't know if you would call these necessarily NSR games, maybe. But if we look at things like, say, Five Torches Deep, Shadow Dark, they've gone in the polar opposite direction. They are exactly what you said. No XP for killing monsters. Gone.
Only
XP for getting treasure. Yep.
Oh, really? I did not know that. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Points. Yeah. Okay, Dan. Okay, points to them. That, I did not know that.
Isn't that fascinating? Right. Huh. Right. I think that's really, really interesting. Huh. Like, I can okay. Throw some up there if you want, but they're yeah. Yep. They've gone completely in that other direction. But it's interesting that they kind of forked in that way, right? And then the origin was both, yeah. Right? The origin is both. And then you can make arguments, and we did, right? And obviously, it's a little hazy here about, like, well, how much, right? In OD&D, what is the percentage of XP coming from monsters versus treasure?
Yep, yep, yep. Yep, unclear. Yep. Didn't explicate it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. What's the other one I was thinking of? There's DCC is a little weird, where it's just... is chunkier, I guess. I don't think it is treasure. It's more you get encounters, whatever that means. Doing stuff.
I'm embarrassed. We played quite a bit of DCC, but I wasn't the ref, so I don't remember what the reward system was.
If you want to look at it, I have it here. Let's see. I'm going to chuck it up here. Here you go. So here's a couple of interesting things. The XP chart is very chunky. Right, 10 XP, yeah, 50 yeah. XP, 110. Right, it's very small. You're getting roughly 0 to 4 XP per encounter, and it's not just for killing monsters or disarming traps or looting treasure, or completing a quest. It's successfully surviving encounters, whatever that means. Right, what is an encounter? And it's very left to the DM to figure out. But just for some comparison's sake, here is this is Five Torches Deep, where you'll see. You get XP for each gold piece of treasure safely captured. Simply discovering the gold or who's holding it doesn't matter. Optionally, the GM can grant XP for things other than gold that are valuable. Bounties, rare discoveries, useful resources. But it doesn't talk about killing monsters at all. That's not here.
All right. Salute. That's I'm kind of impressed, actually. Good idea.
Here's your Shadow Dark how to get XP where the interesting thing about Shadow Dark is it abstracts it. It's not per. It's not one XP per gold piece. It's how big of a treasure did you find? There are four categories: poor, normal, fabulous, and legendary. They are worth this much XP. The end.
Interesting.
And the nice thing about is it kind of you don't get the treasure bloat that you get in the other system, right? Where like now because we are high level, I have to grab these hordes that are just massive amounts, like economy wrecking amounts of treasure. Yeah. We can just say whatever, it's a legendary amount of treasure, whatever that means. And if you look at the Shadow Dark's XP chart, it's real darn simple. 10 XP per level, and the weird thing about Shadow Dark is it resets to 0 between every level. So it does cost more XP every level.
There's a number, I think the original Top Secret did that. I mean, so another way of phrasing that is that we're only tracking the increment, like how much do you need to get to the next level? And, you know, a lot of D&D character sheets will have, but like, what's my experience? And then separately, how much do I need to the next level? So that's a reasonable simplification. You know, that really segues what's interesting about the D&D third edition experience table. Can we bring that up? Because it basically kind of says the same thing. So here's the third edition. You know, and again, this was the first edition that was have a common table. All characters look at the same table. Now that commits the designer to like every class had better be balanced at every level because that's what we're committing to. And I think that's both a hard and maybe not, you know, great goal. But the experience here goes, 1,000, 3,000, 6,000, 10,000. And you might go, well, what? I don't see. It's clearly not doubling. right? It's not geometric anymore like it was before. But what they're doing here is that the increment, right? If you look at the derivative, the first derivative is going up by a constant amount, or in other words, the second derivative is constant. So from first to second, you have to add 1,000. And from second to third, you have to add 2,000. And then you add 3, you add 4, you add 5, you add 6. So if you translated this to, what was the last one? Shadow Dark, is that what you said? Right, this would be to get to second level, you need another 1,000. And then you need another 2,000, you need another 3,000. Right, and it's practically the same thing, just on a different scale from Shadow Dark. And I don't, you know, there is a really compelling reason why you'd want to do this. The problem, there's a significant problem that most people probably aren't aware of in classic D&D, original AD&D or BX, and that is that the increment's the same for the first two level jumps, right? You need, if you're a fighter, you need 2,000 to get to second, and then you need another 2,000 to third. But the thing is, when you're second level, you're double powered, you have twice as many hit points, you have twice as many spells, and you're getting double or more the XP awards from the two hit die monsters and the additional treasure. So generally speaking, in classic D&D, getting that first level is very slow. Like, it can possibly take, what, like 8 adventures or 9 adventures, according to Holmes? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, level 2 goes by in a flash. It might be just like 2 or 3 games, and you're already in third level. So there's this really weird wrinkle in the standard XP system, and third edition does, in fact, fix that by looking at the increment instead, which is kind of an interesting thing that they were observant about. So I kind of have to give them at least 1 point for thinking about that issue.
That is interesting. And I wonder if, is that part of what leads us to, I'm going to jump back to the Shadow Dark chart here. The interesting thing to note about the Shadow Dark chart is that it costs 10 XP to get to level 1. And why is that? Mm-hmm. Because there is a level 0, right? And we see this in DCC as well. You have the funnel, right? Right? You have that, like, is that interesting to say, like, do you think there was an attempt that they were trying to say, well, level 1 is just so interesting, we need extra time on it, or was it just a flub?
I think it was a flub. I mean, standard D&D, I think it was a flub.
It's just interesting to me that you have at least two other systems here now that are trying to say, you know what, it is interesting how you become a hero, and you want to start with like 0 level morons that you're going to play for a session or two just to see, okay, here you go, here's how they make it to herodom.
And you know what? I don't mind. I like having that systemized, even if I don't necessarily want to play it. I actually like having the rules tell me what is the difference between 0 level and first level. And again, I tend to say, like, look, if you don't like playing at first level, you can just play standard D&D at 6. You don't have to declare that first level are world-beating heroes in the first place. Just start at a different level. So I actually kind of don't mind that about those systems. But they didn't
I'm now kicking myself for not having this chart to share, but I want to, before we run out of time, touch then on what happened in 5th edition, right? So here's our 5th edition. I think this is our 5th edition chart, right? This is
It is. It's same in both 14 and 24.
Somewhere along the line, I swear, and I don't remember, but I think I have it here somewhere, and I'm not going to find it, is the like how much XP it costs to go up in level each level in 5th edition. And when you graph it, it's not linear and it's not exponential, and in fact it's bizarre.
There is no normalized formula,
right?
Right.
No, there's no normalized formula for it.
Yeah. So this is one where they went in and they fine-tuned the play experience that they wanted. There is no math formula behind this. And they specifically said that the first, and you know, we've said this on the show sometimes, Paul, we tend to find that the most interesting levels are like level 4 to 8. And most of our design dashes are in that sweet spot. Most classic AD&D adventures are in that sweet spot. And so the 5th edition people said, great, we're going to excel. We're going to put you on a fast slide, right? The 4th level. So very, very small number of XP you need to go through first, second, third. You get the 4th level and all of a sudden it slows down a lot to kind of lock you in there. And they ad hoc change the numbers to force you into this particular play style. And it's also an IP thing, right? It's an intellectual property thing. So you can't just tell your friend, here's the formula for the XP numbers. You have to buy a Wizards of the Coast, a trademark product to see these numbers, because we own these numbers.
That is fascinating. I don't know. What are your thoughts on just the general concept of we tuned it? We manually tuned it based on pragmatic play. Yeah.
Dan don't play that. I like, you know, even if it has some weird wonkiness, or I kind of like a simple formula. I would like to not have to rely on big tables. I would like to be able to tell my friend it's n squared times 1,000 gets you to a particular level.
Yep.
I would prefer that.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. I actually agree with you on this. There's just something about tuning it per level like that based on data that just feels like too much thumb in the scale. Again, I'm right back to the thing I've been complaining about this whole episode, which is I don't want to have to DM fiat anything, right? I just want to know what the hell the stinking rule is. So in to which end, my takeaway from all of this is, this is becoming a recurring theme for me on this show. Another reason I want to try Shadow Dark. I think I got to run some Great. Shadow Dark, Dan. I like what they did here. It's interesting to me.
It's nice that, I mean, there's clearly a lot of love for the original games and a lot of attention paid to the lessons and the experiences that some people have, you know, lost sweat and blood for. So, I have a lot less respect for people that have a complete tabula rasa of like, I know what a fantasy game should be like, and I'm going to, you know, draw it up and ignore all these lessons. And clearly, you know, there's someone behind Shadow Dark that is paying attention to that kind of play and applying the lessons and making edits that I give them points sometimes. I'm pleasantly surprised by some of the decisions. Not every one, but a lot of them.
Yeah. I just have to get over the whole rolling to cast spells part. That's the one that's killing me. That's a topic for another episode.
Yeah. Fascinating.
We're running out of time here, Dan. Any final thoughts? Anything you want to wrap up on here?
That was intense. I don't mind this as a settling point to this episode, actually. So I feel like that was a really intense. And again, we could talk more about awards and our system and the statistics you see in Gygax Adventures. I mean, my main surprise today is that the pre-publication D&D is surprisingly in line with my preferences, actually. Start a fighter at 1,000, great, and then go 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. Wizards are twice that, and your weaker class is half that. That is exactly what I would have asked for, frankly. I like the earlier games. I like embracing treasure-free XP. I like experience points, right? I don't want to abandon that for milestoning. I like players being able to use that as a motivation to push themselves more. I like embracing the asymmetry in the character classes, right? So I like having different tables for different classes. I don't have a lot of classes in my games, and emphasize that you're going to be playing different styles of game when you pick a fighter versus a wizard. And I think it's probably easier to tune your class tables rather than trying to balance every single class at every single level and say they have the exact same power in the game. So if I wasn't aware of the pre-publication tables, I would just recreate them myself, as I kind of like that.
I mean, that's what I wanted to ask is like, would you consider experimenting with it? Would you give it a try? And one of the problems that you and I are both going to hit here is that we both, I think, have this tendency to do pretty laser focused testing these days, where we're our tests, like I think we both do this, right? We like to experiment with what we're doing with the rules, and we do that via running maybe the same scenario multiple times, often in convention settings. And I think if you want to test a leveling system and XP per level and such, You can't really do that in a convention game. You gotta play a longer scale campaign.
Yeah. In our convention game, we never talk experience points, right?
No.
Right? In our one shots, we never even utter the words experience points. So it's complete non-entity. And again, that's one of the major differences between campaign versus convention play. A really good point. It would take a lot more testing. Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. It's a good point. It's not the highest priority for me. It's like,
Yeah. It would be interesting though to see like how would the old XP chart slot into OED.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably have the rewards and make probably give like 20 XP per hit die, and then probably have the money that we're giving out at the moment.
Interesting.
Once in a while, I have said to a friend, like, I am definitely not going to do this, but if I was, here's how I would do it. And inevitably, when I say those words, I wind up actually doing the goddamn thing. So I'm trying to not say that.
I really hard not to say that. Well, as far as Wandering DMs goes, the two things I would like to see is I want to see your one pager on treasure. I'd love to dig into that myself and sort of figure that out in terms with it. And then I think I got to play some Shadow Dark. I think that's inevitable here. I'm going to have to do it so I can talk about it a little bit more and compare.
I've been interested in your quest games, and now I want to hear how your Shadow Dark goes.
Yeah. I still don't have an answer to my quest problem. That was on my end, but I'll figure it out. Viewers, if you have any opinions on what is the best XP chart, how fast do you want to pace out the velocity of your campaign, give us a note here in the YouTube comments. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that'll add to the third future episode that we're rolling off the cuff here.
Definitely. And don't forget that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites, so please look for us there. And aggrandize that like button, please.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find them through third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to our show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, we'd really appreciate a 5-star review. That helps other listeners find us, and we really appreciate it.
And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to visit, join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where, you know, we just have the best, smartest, wisest, most charismatic patrons in all the land. And we're constantly conversing 24/7 about old school D&D, new edition, fourth edition, sometimes miniatures and horror games and experience and numbers and math and other people's blog comments and all this kind of stuff. And it's so great. We would love to see you join us there. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue this conversation, which is intense. And I have more things to say. And I think Paul has more things to say, but we want to hear what you have to say in our live video after chat that's going to be there in about 10 minutes. And maybe, you know, you'll have some kind of, maybe one of our patrons will have some kind of great idea that'll stick in our heads and cause the topic next week to happen, which is what happened in this very episode that you're experiencing right this second. So again, thank you for the patrons for the idea for this great, great topic. And hopefully we'll have more of that in the future. And don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.